miss you when I
back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with Joel Bacco. We're going to discuss Robert Jacoby as we see him in the secret history of Twin Peaks. We'll be discussing his writing as seen in the Twin Peaks Gazette, Oh, What a Tangled Web, and also contradictions in regards to his death. But before we go much further, I'll hand over the mic so Joel can reintroduce himself further.
I am Joel Bacco. I have a lot of work on Twin Peaks online in various capacities. The three big ones are my Lost in Twin Peaks podcast, where I go episode by episode, my video series Journey Through Twin Peaks on YouTube and Vimeo, and also a character series I'm doing that I'm sort of in the middle of now that I'm previewing for patrons before I eventually release it publicly. But I have a lot of other work on films and stuff as well. But those are my three pillars of Twin Peaks right now. And you can find that on lostinthemovies.com.
And I guess to start off, because despite the fact that Robert Jacoby is primarily, if not explicitly, in the secret history of Twin Peaks, there is a lot to deal with just in terms of a lot of the contradictions. But we'll start off at least with Tammy's notes about the Jacoby family, because from what I can see in the secret history is that she indicates that the Jacoby family moved from Twin Peaks to Pearl Harbor in 1939 because Robert and Lawrence's father, Richard Jacoby, was stationed there in the Navy. And then in 1940, Richard and Esther, their mother, divorced. And then that would lead Richard and Robert returning to Twin Peaks. And Lawrence and Esther, who she would later on change her name to Leilani, would stay in Hawaii. Is there anything we should keep in mind in regards to what Tammy's notes are? You know, whether it's the accuracy or anything else relative to the lives growing up for both Robert and Lawrence?
That's a really interesting question, because one of our themes we're going to talk about in this episode is the fact that there are rampant contradictions throughout the book of of Robert Jacoby's chronology. And so you'd think, well, if you're assessing, you know, different narrators, the one you'd want to trust the most is Robert himself. But I would argue maybe we should trust the ones that contradict themselves the least. And Robert himself contradicts himself the most. So maybe he's the least reliable narrator, if we're going to even use those terms for this character. So I would say, when I think of Tammy's kind of footnotes, I don't think they're super contradictory of themselves, if that makes sense. Like, I think obviously she contradicts Robert and the archivist, who turns out to be Major Briggs, and some of the other stuff. But I think the footnotes at least are somewhat internally consistent.
No, because for me, I know that I've had episodes, even some recently, where I've been a little critical on Tammy's contradictions or things that she would get wrong. But I think in the case for anything relating to Robert Jacoby, it seems like she's going by the best possible information. This one, and this is a little more in the realm of Robert's mother, but I thought it was really weird that her name was Esther, and she would change it to Leilani, which would happen to be Dr. Jacoby's wife's name in season two. I know we're kind of getting a little off the weeds, but I just figure it's worth mentioning that that was just a weird thing that I noticed early on.
Yeah, that opens an interesting door too, which is how much, I guess, like, if we think that Mark Frost just made some mistakes here as an author and it wasn't supposed to be contra, because there, you know, there's sort of been arguments that actually he's writing these things to be intentionally contradictory and maybe not. But if he isn't, then you wonder kind of like, okay, well, where was he going with this? Like, where were the kind of contradictions? Like, where do they come from? And it occurred to me reading that, I'm like, I wonder if he remembered that Jacoby mentions that he's going out to visit Leilani. And I think also there's like different spellings of it too, because I feel like in one of the credits or in the script or something, it was like E-O-L-A-N-I. And I think in this it's L-E-O. So maybe it's not, I don't know, maybe they're supposed to be different names, but like they do sound really similar. And I wondered, it's like, does he remember writing about Jacoby going out and visiting her and saying, well, I'm going to retcon it to be his mother, and then maybe not remember that actually we see the wife on the show in one episode? Like she actually shows up at his hospital bed, and it's clearly not his mother. So yeah, if it is supposed to be the same person, that's a contradiction for sure. But I it may just be similar names. I'm not sure.
Oh yeah. No, it's just something I noticed early on, and I figured it was worth addressing because it was like the first of many, if not contradictions, at least things that were just a little off that set the tone to just kind of be on your toes when it comes to Robert. But I guess to start off with Robert Jacoby's proper introduction is that he's introduced in the Twin Peaks Gazette on September 6, 1947, on an article called "Look to the Skies," and this is about Einar Jennings, who I think is the grandfather, or at least a relative of Hank Jennings, about how he spotted a UFO, and this would actually lead to unintended consequences from Robert, because this would lead Dougie Milford back to Twin Peaks and strong-arming Einar Jennings into keeping quiet about the UFO. Is there anything we should talk about the elements of Mark Frost that he had in Twin Peaks, or the secret history of Twin Peaks, rather, and all the things that Robert factored into even accidentally?
Yeah, that's an interesting point because mostly Robert Jacoby, his material is in like the Twin Peaks history parts of the book, where he's just talking about the characters of the town. Like he even writes a book that's literally the history of the town. But in that part, even though it is that as well, he's also touching on the whole UFO section, which is like maybe half of the secret history is like Dougie Milford and the government and UFOs and the Kennedy assassination and all of that, like constellation of stuff. But yeah, I guess you could almost come up with like a few different like overlapping Venn diagrams of what Robert Jacoby covers, because a lot of his town stuff is kind of it does have a supernatural tinge, like the stuff with the log lady and the three kids, one of whom is the log lady, disappearing into the woods and all of that. This feels like maybe the most in purely like the UFO, like secret agent realm, this story.
And yeah, because I think that even though we're going to be talking about the contradictions about Robert Jacoby, I don't think this article is one of them, because Dougie Milford does talk about this pretty extensively in subsequent pages after this article. So I think that when it comes to anything we know about Robert Jacoby just being like this, young, gifted writer, or at least a very articulate writer and perceptive, that there is that this part at least seems like it tracks pretty well with like what we're presented. Not even a week later, Robert Jacoby would write "All's Well That Ends Well," and this would chronicle the events of Margaret Colson, Carl Rodd, and I believe Alan Trahern returning safe and sound regarding they're missing for 3 days straight. Since we're kind of in the weeds about UFOs, where do you stand on Margaret, Carl, and Alan in terms of relative to the UFOs to the woods?
Yeah, I think Mark Frost, as I recall, I haven't reread the whole Secret History recently. I focused mostly on just the Robert Jacoby stuff for this episode, but as I recall, he goes really far back into the UFO. It's almost like a boomerang thing. Like he goes way back into the UFOs that seemed like they were dismissed at the end of the show. And then at the end of the book, it kind of boomerangs again back to, well, maybe they aren't like aliens and spaceships. Maybe they are extra dimensional beings, and it is more rooted in things like the woods than outer space. So in that sense, I would say, even though it's surrounded by all this UFO material, I think ultimately it fits with what we hear on the or the sense we get on the show, which is they're not like being abducted by aliens so much as maybe entering into lodge space somehow or being sort of absorbed into the spirit world momentarily. Or for several days, but to their mind, momentarily.
Yeah, no, because I think for me, I when I think of when I think of like the like how I guess the abductions as they are shown by Major Briggs in season two and in the Secret History, I don't think of it as explicitly UFOs, but I do know that Mark Frost, when he was doing Conversation with Mark Frost, the book by David Bushman, I think he talked about how he wanted the owls to be basically like aliens, and I just kind of figured that this was his opportunity to kind of lean really further into that realm.
Yeah, I don't know, because doesn't he in the end sort of have Milford and maybe even like Nixon at some point say, I think they've been here a long time, or maybe it's like Major Briggs. Somebody in the end says like, well, I think they maybe been here as long as we've been here. I'm not sure they're aliens or something. Like that's my memory of it, that he kind of walks it back. But even though he goes way further into UFO stuff than the show does. Like at the end, it's sort of like he hedges his bets a little to be like, well, maybe it's still spirits from the woods or, you know, some larger supernatural force we don't understand.
Yeah, I feel that way as well. And actually, I'm going to place more of an emphasis on Margaret in season two. And this will tie back into this article, is that, you know, when she talks about being missing, how she was gone for 3 days, was only gone, but like, you know, she thought it was only like an hour or two and had the marking. But I guess the reason why I'm bringing this up is that, you know, it seems like Robert Jacoby, who's a writer, he's talking about how these are explicitly like 9-year-olds in the third grade. And, you know, this is just setting the precedent that there's going to be a blatant major contradiction regarding Robert Jacoby and Margaret Coulson's relationship, you know, as we get to later. But yeah, I just want to follow up on that. And then moreover, the reason why I'm bringing up the UFO part is that Tammy notes that there is no follow-up article after this appeared. And then also she actually questions if Dougie Milford paid Robert Jacoby a visit. So, you know, coming back to the whole, you know, the UFO part, there's got to be something, because I actually did at the time of this recording relatively recent research on Dougie Milford, and I don't think he's a good person around this time in Secret History.
Yeah,
I do wonder if there is something to be said about if Dougie Milford did something to strong arm Robert Jacoby like he did Einar Jennings. And I don't know if it would really say anything about the contradictions of Robert Jacoby. But I do think it's worth mentioning that if Tammy is thinking that Dougie Milford paid a visit to him, that there is probably some credence to that.
I like that idea too, because Robert Jacoby, I think he is sort of an ambiguous character, like beyond all the chronological contradictions. Like, you read his stuff and he seems like a very amiable, thoughtful, maybe somewhat sentimental guy. And then like Tammy's very dismissive in her notes. This, she calls his book this piece of civic puffery or something like that. And there's the whole weird aspect, which we'll get to, of like Jacoby's role at the newspaper after Milford buys it. He basically buys the newspaper to be like a propaganda organ in Twin Peaks for himself and his like right-wing politics and stuff. And depending which chronology you believe, Robert Jacoby is at the paper for like 16 years after that. So, yeah, there is a little bit of an ambiguity there where it's like this very likable character. But if you take a step back, you're like, really, what was his role in the community? Was he kind of covering things up? Was he using sort of like sentiment to sweep things under the rug? It's interesting because that's also very different from Lawrence Jacoby, who has many, many flaws, but is generally not somebody who is interested in sort of coming up with a sentimental cover story for anything. You know, he's pretty frank and open to the darkness and all of that. Maybe too much so at times, but yeah.
Because you actually touched upon about Tammy being critical about Robert Jacoby, because we do get a segment of Oh What a Tangled Web, and it's primarily about the Packers, Horns, and the Martells and their history in Twin Peaks. But yeah, Tammy gets really scathing at the end, because Robert, he's talking about the story about how Pete and Catherine, how despite the fact that they are families who are rivals, that they fell in love. And then Tammy refers to it as an amateurish slice of Chamber of Commerce civic puffery, which is the most bizarrely eloquent and vindictive thing that you could say, that I really can't see Christabel saying in The Return or even in any real form.
Yeah. Speaking of contradictions, it is, I don't know, I believe you did a Tammy Preston episode, right?
Oh, no, not yet. I just bring her up a lot in every episode.
I'm looking forward to that, because I know you like to sort of split things into their different spheres, and it would make total sense if you did Tammy and Tamara, book and show, but it would also be kind of fun to talk about them in the same episode, because they are so wildly different, you know, in tone and everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is veering a little off topic, but I have wondered how I would format a Tammy Preston episode, because there's so much of the Mark Frost books and a role in The Return, but they seem so contradictory with how they act in each one.
Yeah, and she is a very like scathing in the books. I mean, I always think of like poor Bill Hastings, who she like interviews very simple. I know we're getting a little off of track, but she interviews him so sympathetically on the show. And then in the book, she's like, this stupid hick who thought he knew what he was doing. I can't believe they hacked our database. It's like, whoa, okay.
There are just times where it's like, I'll see Tammy say something. I just think like, and actually, to be fair, I will say this, that even though I do like get pretty critical on Tammy getting stuff blatantly wrong, especially in the final dossier, there is still nothing that's really contradictory for her. That if anything, that, you know, as we'll see, Robert Jacoby's the one who's far more contradictory. We do have a bit of a jump because even though offhand, I don't know when Oh, What a Tangled Web was released in relative to what was in Secret History of Twin Peaks. On November 14th of 1968, Robert Jacoby would write From the Jaws of Victory. And this would be about Hank fumbling the ball at the first championship banner. I don't know if this is worth addressing. I think on its own, the article is fine enough, but it does seem like there was probably, you know, potential inconsistencies with the access guide. Is there anything we should talk about in regards to, inconsistencies, whether it's in the article itself, subsequent writings, or, you know, other media?
Yeah, the access guide is fascinating because I think Frost has said, and it seems evident in the book, that he did actually go back. For all the contradictions that are within the secret history, he did try to kind of match a lot of stuff that was in the access guide. I think overall, and I almost feel like somebody's asked him this, it's like, if there's a contradiction, trust the secret history more, I think was the kind of the idea of it. Like, that's the more official version. But he does kind of, yeah, there's the difference, I think, between those two is that in the access guide, they win the game, right?
I remember it seemed like the way they described the game was more unceremonious. It was really just how a lot of the numbers on the football team were different. Like, I know that offhand, Hank Jennings, I think it's 80 in the secret history. It's 81 in the access guide, or I could have him reverse. But, and again, you could say that maybe it's, it's a different year in high school, but there's just a lot of small things that just seemed like they're off. And that's not even going to the fact that the access guide is deliberately incomplete in certain spots as well.
Yeah, the access guide is almost like a first draft because when he writes secret history, again, he doesn't disregard it. Like, he goes back and he consults it and he draws things from it. Like, just the fact that we have a whole football game in the late 60s that is like a big deal and all the like familiar characters from the show are on the team. He takes that idea and repeats it in secret history. He just changes a bunch of the details. But like, the fact that it's included at all tells me that, you know, access guide is not like totally irrelevant, if that makes sense.
I do go through the access guide whenever I do each episode, because even though I do have a little more of a dismissive attitude overall, there's a lot of fun stuff you can find through it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just, I think that this is veering off a little bit from Robert Jacoby, but I think it was, of all people, it was Dale Cooper who was following up this this article from the Jaws of Victory. And he was the one talking about Hank knowing Jean Renault for like 15, 20 years beforehand, and that Jean Renault was the one that was deliberately sabotaged this game because, quote unquote, he could. Again, I'm kind of going with the unintended consequences of Robert Jacoby's writing, but it's just kind of weird how this stuff that, you know, he writes that we'll see someone else interpret it, but then what we see based on the show is just totally contradictory.
Yeah, it's, again, we have a situation here, like Cooper kind of coming in, intervening. So is that one Cooper or is it the archivist? I couldn't remember.
I think it is Cooper because he's going through the Andrew Packard files it's all the people that are affiliated with that.
So in that case too, we have somebody kind of saying, okay, you've just heard the kind of surface version of this. Now here's what really happened. And it's funny. I mean, first of all, it's funny that Robert Jacoby, I guess he's a sports writer for the newspaper as well. Like, he's just writing about everything. Like, he doesn't really have like a specific lane. He just kind of writes about every topic, which is funny. And also, apparently, we'll get to this, owns the newspaper, but doesn't. So he's kind of like jack of all trades at the newspaper. But it's like, even in his sports, high school sports articles, he's like covering stuff up or not getting to the bottom of things. You know, like, it's the same thing as with his like UFO stuff and his, some of his other, you know, things he writes about. It's like, even just this high school football game, there's a whole hidden story that he can't even really get at. He sort of hints at it a little in the article, but just describes everything at face value. And you could argue maybe, you know, if he's supposed to be just a straight up reporter, like, he's just got to report the facts that are evident. Like, he's not he's not an investigative reporter, certainly not when it comes to a high school football game, you know. But it is, there is a pattern there of him just everything he writes about, he kind of hints at something, and then it requires other people to come in and be like, okay, here's the real deal.
I will say, though, and I mentioned this because, you know, he will reemerge as more important. But I will say, though, is that I think in terms of being trying to have more integrity in their work and their work at the Twin Peaks Gazette or Twin Peaks Post later on, I think that Robert Jacoby, by and large, at least tries to be more consistent than Dougie Melford. Because you were talking before is that Dougie Melford, he comes at it from like a very distinct political angle, and you know, much to the dismay of his brother Dwayne Melford as well. But I guess, you know, that leads into the first real major not plot hole, but definitely a big talking point, is that Major Briggs writes that Robert Jacoby died in 1969, and this was after Dougie Melford returned to Twin Peaks. And this is when Project Blue Book was disbanded and Richard Nixon told him to lay low. This is in because of the quote unquote death of Robert Jacoby, Dougie took over the Twin Peaks Gazette and would rename it as the Twin Peaks Post.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the first death. Yeah. This keyword of is being first of yeah. Robert. Is there anything that we should address about Robert's fate and anything else relating to that at the moment?
Yeah, there are a few things that just really stick out here. So first of all, as you said, this is not, it's not only the first death. I think it is the first blatant contradiction in the book. And I actually remember reading it. Or I guess it's not a contradiction yet, because as far as we know, he died in 1969. It's the first thing that like gets contradicted is what I would say. Because within, let's see, I actually like we're kind of figured out what pages all this stuff is on, but within like I think about no actually you know what it is the first contradiction, because when we're talking about Lawrence Jacoby, the archivist, about 80 pages before this, says that he came back to town in 1981, unless I have this out of order, but I'm pretty sure he says he came back to town in 1981 to help his brother who was suffering from MS. So now, almost 80 pages later, you get this thing about the archivist talking about Doug. So this is the archivist contradicting himself, in fact, if I'm not mistaken. The archivist saying here that Dougie returned to town in 69, and a few weeks after the moon landing, Robert Jacoby died, and Dougie bought the newspaper. So he's now telling us that the character he told us had MS 12 years later, 80 pages back, because there are some areas where the book kind of goes back and forth in time. And I believe we've already met Dr. Lawrence Jacoby. We've read a bit of his book on drugs and saw his report on Nadine and all of that. So like we've already gotten the story that Robert's still alive. So yeah, at this point, I remember reading this. It's got on page 286, like the first time I read this book in 2016, going, wait a second, he's dead in 1969. And I think I flipped back and was like, hold on. Like that was where I started to like doubt Robert, I guess you could say.
For me, there's two ways I can go by with this, because we're again to layers of contradictions. I guess I'll start with that one, because they say Dougie Melford returns after the moon landing, but that's not even going to the fact that it must be an earlier page. It's earlier pages, but Norma sends a postcard to her mother, and it's supposed to be about a stamp relating to the first moon landing, but it's April of 1969, which obviously happened months later. I know this is like veering off from Robert Jacoby, but is that something worth mentioning relative to Dougie Melford returning specifically saying after the moon landing?
You know, it's funny that his book is called Oh, What a Tangled Web, because that certainly describes his life and everything related to it. So, yeah, that's a good point. There is a contradiction to do with the moon landing in the book. And then the moon landing is used as this kind of benchmark for another contradiction, which is, you know, when Dougie, I guess not when Dougie bought the newspaper, but what Robert Jacoby's role in all that is. So I want to point out a couple other things about that. First of all, it describes him as the editor and publisher of the Gazette, who Dougie changes the name to the Post. And there's really no evidence of this anywhere else in the secret history that he's the editor and publisher. Like he's always just kind of a staff writer. He describes himself at one point as like a struggling journalist in the early 1960s. So, you know, and they, I think it says longtime editor and publisher. So that's very odd. I, one of my thoughts about that was this would still be an error on Frost's part, but it would be like a cleaner one. Is what if he meant to write Richard Jacoby, who is like Rob, who is the dad of Robert and Lawrence? Because they never tell us, well, he was in the army, but they don't really tell us what he did, or Navy, which was he in?
Oh, it says Navy, at least when Tammy introduces him.
Yeah, so maybe he was lifelong military, but we never really find out what he did after the war. And so there's a thought, well, maybe he was the editor publisher and he gave his son a job as the writer, and then he died and his son kept working. That would make sense, but I mean, that's not on the page. It says Robert. So I'm extrapolating to come up with like a mistake which would make more sense than the mistake that was made, I guess. But that thought did occur to me. It's like maybe that was supposed to be the dad. I don't know.
I know you mentioned it when you're on Twin Peaks Unwrapped, but I think one thing that's worth mentioning about Major Briggs is that later on, I think it's later on after he talks about Robert Jacoby's quote unquote death in 1969, but Garland, he does talk about when he disappears in the woods and when he returns. It's very different from what we see in the book as in the show because, you know, in season two, he just reappears in the, you know, in the Briggs home. But the way it's described in the secret history is that I think he returns to the woods, gets a drink of water, and walks home. Do you think there's anything we should keep in mind about all, you know, different timelines or anything pertaining to Briggs's perspective of the world?
Yeah, I guess there's two ways to look at all that stuff, which is one, the sort of the in-world explanation. Is there like a time quake or these different alternate timelines, et cetera, which doesn't really help us with Robert Jacoby, to be honest, because some of his contradictions are like within the same article. But I guess so that's one way to look at it. And the other way is to ask, okay, what, again, if Frost made a mistake here, like where did it come from? Like what was he going for? Or if it wasn't even a mistake, if he made a choice, let's say, why did he make that choice? And I think with Briggs and some of the other stuff, it's almost like a cleaner version. Like when they were writing season two, it was very seat of the pants. It was supposed to be Audrey and Cooper was going to be the main through line. That got nixed. So suddenly they're doing stuff with like Jean Reno and Dead Dog Farm and, oh, Major Briggs, why don't we have him disappear at this point? And then he comes back and he's helping out. And now it's going to be about the lodges. It's kind of a mess. So I feel like what he does in the secret history is just from a storytelling point of view, it's like cleaner. It's like Major Briggs is helping out a little bit, or at least not helping out, but sort of like peripheral to the Laura Palmer investigation. Then boom, he disappears and he comes back right on the cusp of the climax. Like it's a kind of a cleaner, neater version of the drama, if that makes sense. So I kind of get why he did some of that. Like even the stuff with Ed and Nadine, it's like I don't necessarily think it's better than what we got on the show, but it's like, it's just like a different story he wanted to tell about them, you know? It's almost like a different sort of contradiction than the Robert Jacoby stuff, where again, it's like internally within the same text contradictory. So I kind of make a distinction like that in my mind. So I guess I'm saying I look at them so differently. It's hard for me to use one sort of type of contradiction to determine that Major Briggs is like obscuring something. That's just kind of my perspective on it. But I'd be curious to hear yours. If you do you feel like there is kind of a through line in the types of ways that Major Briggs fudges things?
There's been a few things. I guess you know, I did mention the potential alternate timelines because of how his reappearance was different in the show as it was depicted here. I have also considered, and I think this is a bit flimsy, but I was thinking about how near the end of the book, when Major Briggs and Dougie Milford, yeah, Major Briggs, he does admit that he's become so focused with his work and that there's a lot of problems at home that he's ignoring. I have kind of wondered if maybe like Major Briggs, he's just kind of making like, you know, lapses of judgment. Like, you know, it's like, you know, it's just like, his, you know, he's doing the best he can, but there's like other things that are on his mind and maybe he like will miswrite or misremember something offhand.
So more of a mistake than like an intentional covering up.
Yeah, at least in some cases, that's when I think of like, now that you mentioned Robert Jacoby might have been Richard Jacoby. I think that could add credence to it. I know Mark Frost, he's talked about a couple of times is that, you know, history can be misremembered by people. And I think that even though Major Briggs is a very gifted person, that he is, you know, that he can still make those mistakes.
And it's funny, it's like, I don't know how you rank these things. Like the stuff in the Log Lady article are totally inexplicable contradictions. So it's hard to say, oh, this is more so, but it does feel like the most dramatic contradiction in the whole book is to have Robert Jacoby die twice at two totally different times and then have a bunch of articles he wrote after we've been told that he died. So if we can put something at the top of the list, which is hard to do, that would probably be at the top of the list. And it is interesting. Yeah, it's something that Major Briggs both sort of like the initial information we get about his sickness and death is from Major Briggs, and so is the contradiction like 80 pages later.
Well, now we have to talk about the ultimate contradiction. This is kind of the thing that we've been holding off for some time, is that on October 28th, 1986, despite the fact that Major Briggs said that Robert Jacoby died in 1969, he writes an article for Twin Peaks Post called "If These Woods Could Speak, and Trust Me, They Do," which chronicles Margaret Lenormand's life and his history with her. So, before we get to the article itself, do you think that there's anything about the death in 1969 that undercuts or undermines what Robert is going to talk about with Margaret Lanerman with us?
Well, I mean, just the fact of the death is the big thing. Like the fact that he's supposed to be dead. I mean, that's so blatant that it almost eclipses everything else. But I guess some of the other details we get, first of all, if not just the fact that he's writing in 1986, but a lot of the stuff he describes happened after 1969. So there's that. And also that, like I said before, he describes himself as a struggling journalist in the 60s. And then we find out like he owns the newspaper, which could still be a struggling newspaper owner for sure, but it's a little different thing that than saying you're a struggling journalist. I think it's just the age thing in general. Like he is at least three different ages in this article alone by itself. And like him dying in 1969 after supposedly being a longtime editor publisher is almost like a fourth age that we have to contend with. That he's supposed to be. So there's that. But I think most of the contradictions are, again, within this very article. Because even the stuff that contradicts the earlier article about the three kids disappearing, like it's not just that, like, this article contradicts that. Like, he repeats the things from that earlier article in this article. So, like, it really is the most internally inconsistent passage in the entire book.
One thing I think that is worth mentioning is that, you know, we were talking about, you know, trusting the secret history over the access guide to the town. But I think it is worth addressing that Margaret Lanerman's log, in one of the books, it's referred to as a Douglas fir tree, and another, it's Ponderosa pine. I think it's in the secret history, it's referred to as Ponderosa pine. Yeah, you know, you think that someone, because, you know, Robert will talk about, you know, his time knowing Margaret from childhood up until this point of this article. But, you know, it's just kind of strange that, you know, how could he write something like this and just get, you know, potentially get the log itself wrong?
Aside from his own life that he completely jumbles, it's like, yeah, now that's interesting because I think Ponderosa Pine is what it actually was, right? Like the actual log that Catherine Colson held on the show.
And I think that's what it said in the access guide. So the fact that it's referred to as Douglas fir in the secret history,
Oh, it's Douglas fir in this one. Gotcha. Okay.
even though I think that that was my starting point, that might be the least of our problems with this
It is,
article,
yeah.
because you know, as we said before, he you know, he was must have been like a teenager when he wrote the article in the Twin Peaks Gazette about Margaret Colson,
At the
Carl Rotz.
least, at the very least, yeah.
Yeah, it's that Margaret Lenormand, Carl Rodd, and Alan Trahern, that they were abducted when they were three, they're in third grade. But
Yep.
here it is, Robert talking about not only being in the same class with her, but
Yep.
specific details about their teacher.
Yep.
Yeah, it's and seated behind her.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre to me. Like, this is the
It's
one,
very
if
strange.
there's one hair-pulling contradiction, this is it. And I know that we've been talking about stuff in universe, but do you think there's any chance that Mark Frost, you know, with all the stuff that he was piling up to do a book like this, that he might have just misconstrued his own continuity about Robert Jacoby?
Well, this is what's so baffling because, again, he says in this article, he says that he was like in the third grade with her and she came back to class. So I guess when I say that he repeats the stuff, the thing that he repeats from that earlier article is that it's 1947. So it's like he's still setting it in that year. And that totally contradicts other things that Jacoby tells us about his own age in this article. And then a page later, when it says how old he was when he died and everything like that, or what year he was born. It's almost hard to talk about because it's so there's so many levels of contradiction to this. But let's take the article in isolation. So let's forget that he wrote an article about Margaret, you know, in 1947 when he's supposedly the same age as her in third grade. Forget that part because I don't think he mentions that in this article. Let's just say, okay, that didn't happen. He's a third grader, he's the same age as her, etc. He then tells us. So this is, and he says in the article, it's 1947. He then goes on to say that they date went on a few dates in high school. They saw the movie Invaders from Mars, which came out in 1953. Which incidentally also, this is so minor compared to the other stuff. Margaret's a little bit young to be third grade in 1947 and high school in 1953. Because she's seven in the doctor's report that we're shown,
You're right. I totally forgot about the doctor's
which
report.
is possible. Like if you, so it's in September. If I don't know how Washington State is, I'm from New Hampshire. There, like you have to like September 30th basically to go in either grade. So I guess if she turned eight at the end of September by that standard, you know, so it's close. It's not a grant. I'll give him that. But then 13 and 1953, a little young for high school. But again, you know, okay, that's the least of our worries. So then it starts to get really crazy. He's given us references to things that are certain dates. Okay, yeah, here it is. One night in 1947, during a school outing, Margaret and two other classmates disappeared overnight. So he says in this article, he's now told us that he was born. Implicitly, he was born around 1938, 39, 40, and Margaret was as well. And we know she was supposedly seven from the earlier report. But even if we disregard that, just again, I want to look at this article and let's pretend that this article exists as its own sealed text. We don't have to consider anything else. So now we've got that information. And then we hear that during high school, I actually tried to put this in the order of the years that it takes place in my notes. So I can't even look at that because that tries to make more sense of it than it makes in the actual thing. So I'm going to read it in the article in the order that he writes about it. He talks about her going, you know, being taken in the woods and coming back and how she was different from that point on. They went on dates to see this movie that came out in the early 50s. So here we have, like, directly, this is the next paragraph talking about Invaders from Mars. Again, 1953. That turned out to be the last time I saw Maggie for a while. Our family had moved to Hawaii when I was a small child. My father was an army officer who'd been posted to Pearl Harbor. Our parents divorced soon afterward, and I moved back to Twin Peaks with my father, who'd been reassigned to an air base in Spokane, while my mother and younger brother stayed in Hawaii. Okay. So. That could theoretically be before the disappearance of Margaret, before the third grade. He does say a small child, but we're talking like one or two, little younger than he's suggesting, especially if he already has a younger brother. And by the way, it completely contradicts the earlier information we got where it's like, you know, they're already much older kids. But forget that, forget all that. Again, we're just considering this article on its own. We're starting to stretch the bounds of plausibility here. Okay, so he rewound to told us what hap to tell us what happened before he and Margaret were, you know, acquainted. Okay, but wait a second. He then says, we didn't see each other during the war. I mean, that's got to be World War II. But once it ended, I rejoined them in Honolulu for the last semester of my senior year. So he just went from being about one or two when they moved to Hawaii to 4 years later being 18, which is now before he's supposedly in the third grade in 1947 with Margaret. And he's writing about all this as if this is taking place after everything he just told us about dating her in the 50s. It's nuts. It's insane. Like, and it's not just insane in the sense of getting something wrong. Like, how would you even write this? Because it's like seamless. Like, it flows from one paragraph to the other. It says, that turned out to be the last time I saw Maggie for a while. Like, he's directly, all I can think in terms of how this process took place is he wrote like different versions of this and then like stitched them together. Like, he wrote something and then he went back and like, oh, I should add something in about the war. And like, it's just so hard. And like, he's pretty, you know, this is a guy, big history buff. Obviously he knows that it's not like he doesn't know that World War II was in the 40s. Like, you know, like there's not like, that's not what's going on here. He's just like going back and like stitching in things that like, it's crazy. Now we're already at the point where it's crazy. He then says, so he moved back to Honolulu for the last semester of his senior year. We've now rewound from the 50s to suddenly it's 1945, 2 years before he supposedly met her. So I missed graduation, but I did learn to surf a little. By this point, my younger brother Lawrence could ride the waves like a dolphin. Okay, whatever. And then after that remarkable summer, I returned to Washington for college, Gonzaga, journalism. And by the time I made it back to Twin Peaks with my degree, 5 more years had gone by. So he's now completely blanked out the whole period he just told us that he met her, which was 1947. He's saying from 1945 to 1950-51, he was not in Twin Peaks because he was 10 years older than he just told us he was in that time. Oh my God. Yeah, it's just wild.
One other thing that I think is worth addressing. Yeah, in all fairness, the next thing I'm going to mention, it was Tammy was the one who said that Richard Jacoby was the one in the Navy. But in this article, Robert does talk about how his father was an Army officer and he was reassigned to the Air Force Base in Spokane. Now, it's not out of the realm of possibility that you could just, you know, go from the Navy to the Army, but I don't know, like, you know, with all the contradictions we were talking about, you know, is, you know, from this article alone, you know, is there any, like, I don't know, is there any merit to this?
Yeah, here's the possibility, and this doesn't work either. He's not talking about World War II. You could say in this version, again, we're hermetically sealing this from everything else, just this article. He's saying, well, my dad was assigned to Pearl Harbor. It wasn't like Pearl Harbor at the time of the attack. It was like Pearl Harbor in the 50s. Okay, maybe. But then he said, but the mess that this makes of it is the war. He says, we didn't see each other during the war. There's no way to fit that in the chronology. Korean War was 50 to 53. So if he is 14, 15, he's not a senior in high school. Like, we're just, you know, so it can't be the Korean War. Also, why would you say not, we didn't see each other during the war? I mean, we know by inference he's talking about World War II. Like, even if we leave out the other part, Vietnam isn't for another decade. He should be graduating high school around 1958. It's like crazy. It's, there's no explanation for it. And so then he says he reunited with Maggie. Now they're like in their 20s or whatever. He's graduated from college. And presumably now it's like, and this is the funny thing about it, because he uses such completely contradictory timelines in the same article, we can read this and like simultaneously be like, almost like Lawrence Jacoby glasses, red and blue. It's like, look at it through one lens and he's talking about reuniting with her in the early 50s. And through another lens, he's talking about reuniting with her in the early 60s. And then he does quantify it because he says, you know, one night, early 60s now, a decade before the first Earth Day, blah, blah, blah. So it kind of quantifies it. We're back to the timeline we would expect if they were both students in 1947. And then she's like in the 70s, because he says she's like the wrong side of 30. That's when she gets married to her husband and then he dies. And then we have something where it's not like, it's not a total contradiction, But it is kind of odd a little bit. And granted, this character has multiple sclerosis. He's kind of aging prematurely in a sense, in the sense that like he's experiencing a lot of health problems most people his age wouldn't go through. But he is talking at the end of this article like he's like in his 60s or 70s. Our generation, I've watched us all grow old. It's like, well, wait a second, you're supposed to be about 46 if you were in third grade. Like you're still, pretty early in like middle age. Why are you talking like, you've watched your whole generation pass away? And then you turn the page and we have his funeral card and he's born in 1931. So now he's like in his 50s, which is a little old. It's still a little young to be talking about how you've watched your whole generation. What's the word he uses? He says, over the years, I've borne witness to our generation ages as our generation ages, slows, and slips apart. As time strains the fabric of our narrative, that's been my life's work. Again, this is a guy who's like, at the very least, he could be 46. At most, according to the next page, he's 55. And then he says he's been chronicling the town for nearly 50 years. So, like, did he start when he was five? Did he start when he was negative 10? It's just so that's this article. It's funny because we've talked where I'm nitpicking the hell out of it, but it's hard, it's pretty blatant stuff. Like, it's paragraphs back to back to each other. But it's funny because it's also like the most humanity we get from Robert Jacoby in the whole book. Like, this is like his most poignant kind of moment, even though it's focused on another character. We get a lot of his own life in it. Like, there's sort of genuine emotion there, but you're pulled in two directions at once because half the time you're like, but this doesn't make any sense.
That's the biggest conundrum about this whole article is that it's like the most poignant part about Margaret Landerman's life. And I asked the question before, just by virtue of an article in 1986 coming out, after he died in 1969. But when he goes to the story about knowing Margaret, put aside
Yeah.
contradictions, but the broad
Yeah,
stroke of like knowing
it's
her
nice.
falling in love with Sam, him dying the night in a fire,
Yeah.
how she handled herself. It's like very powerful stuff, but because of the contradictions of Robert Jacoby, just in this article alone, does that undercut anything that we know about Margaret or anything we should call into question?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question because I think that gets to the heart of how we interpret this character and the contradictions. It's like it's almost like if you give Mark Frost the quote unquote credit of saying he was conscious of all this and he did it on purpose, you're actually almost sort of diminishing his work because you're saying like he doesn't want us to take this moving story of Margaret Colson slash Lanterman seriously because it's really an expose of how this character is a fabrication and maybe like the whole article was made up by Major Briggs to cover it. But there's also, I have other issues with that too, which is I don't think it achieves anything other than sort of a general sense of sl the slipperiness of time. But there are other ways to do that. So it's almost like if you give Mark Frost too much credit and say, oh, this wasn't like, he wasn't trying to meet deadlines and putting together different drafts that actually contradicted each other. He meant to do this. Like it kind of saps the emotion. Whereas if you say, look, the guy just got lost in his own maze that he made, and the chronology makes no sense. But this stuff is meant, the emotion of it is meant to be taken sincerely, So I would almost think it's more generous to say he totally flubbed the chronology, but he meant what he said about like Margaret and all that. So that's kind of my two cents on that part. It's like I almost feel like in the attempt to make him sound like he's on top of everything, people are sort of undercutting him as a storyteller in a weird way, even if they mean to not to do the opposite.
I think what makes this particular article so bizarre is that I guess we'll mention the last part is that Margaret told Robert that he had quote unquote nothing to fear long before this article was published, and it wouldn't be his last article in the Twin Peaks Post. And the reason why I'm bringing this is so bizarre is that we have the funeral card that he does indeed die a few weeks later to substantiate it. It talks about his complications with MS. It talks about Dr. Jacoby, how he spoke at services at the Chapel in the Woods, 200 plus attended, which I think says that Robert was a very well respected individual, and his ashes are scattered at Pearl Lakes. Which, by the way, that's actually a contradiction. But the thing is that Tammy, she writes down that the archivist, being Major Briggs, that he wrote what he remembered of Margaret's speech as best as he could at Robert's funeral. And I think this is why I want to tie back to Major Briggs talking about Robert Jacoby's death in 1969, is that, it's like, how much can we really, hold under scrutiny regarding Robert Jacoby if Major Briggs got something wrong in 1969 and is only, going by like Margaret's speech by memory?
So you're saying, like, how much can we trust specifically the archivist stuff?
Yeah, because I think what's so weird is that, because with the previous article we were talking about the contradictions that Robert himself were saying, but now we have the layers of contradictions, because even though we have a funeral card to confirm his birth date and death date, that the last and probably one of the most poignant parts of it was what Garland Briggs would remember from that speech.
So he, yeah, right. Right. Yeah, I think it's Major Briggs's stuff is almost, it feels easier to like rationalize. Like you said, like maybe he meant to refer to his dad. That's something, or maybe he's cover, I don't know what he'd be covering up. I think the covering up theory that a lot of people have about stuff in the secret history is, I almost like it less than just like kind of throwing in the ball and being like, yeah, Frost just got some stuff wrong, because it just doesn't, it doesn't feel like it goes anywhere, with what we see in the return. Like, I mean, there are certain things, like I think Cameron Cloutier has sort of pointed out, it's like Major Briggs never mentions Annie in that book. And I can kind of buy that as a thing, like where, like, yeah, maybe you would want to hide the existence of Annie. That kind of makes sense to me. But like some of the other stuff of like what's the point of having this character who then contradicts himself in all these ways? Like, who is Major Briggs? What is he concealing with that? I don't know that I can piece something together. I do think it's interesting, kind of in world, to think about Jacoby, Robert Jacoby himself, as a kind of slippery figure who's ignoring things or papering them over in some way, and that whether by accident or not, his own contradictions kind of reflect that. There's like a neat kind of mirroring there. But yeah, I guess I have trouble thinking, like, what would, if it's intentional, what would Major Briggs be achieving with that? As far as it being accidental, yeah, I think, again, it's like the Jacoby article about the log lady is the one part of all of this that is like just sticks out like a sore thumb. The rest of it you can kind of rationalize, even the death in 69, I guess.
I'm one of the people that subscribes to the idea that it is a cover-up. And I think of how at the end of the Secret History, it's when Garland, he's talking about, it's after the events of season two, and he talks about how Del Cooper is coming to the Briggs home, and then like he urgently says, like, he must go up to in as it would say in the final dossier, to just discard and get rid of everything so Cooper's doppelganger doesn't come up. And the thing is that I can kind of look at maybe this dossier at large is supposed to be like a lot of dead ends in the event that Mr. C comes across it. But when you look at this article from 1986 that Robert Jacoby wrote, and like I was like, would Garland really go out of his way to really doctor this in particular? And also, like, even in if we're talking about, like, all these clues that are actually dead ends, would this really be worth the effort to doctor?
Yeah, it's like if I guess if I really pushed myself to try to come up with an in-world explanation for Jacoby being so flimsy, it's like maybe Robert Jacoby is like a cutout for Milford or somebody else. Like he doesn't actually exist, and he's, but again, it's like, why then have that person write an article about the log lady? That's such like a moving tribute, and then her write a moving tribute to him, like a eulogy. So the more I try to rationalize it, the more it wrecks the like whatever emotional weight it has, So I'm kind of caught in a tug of war with that.
Yeah, because you do mention that about Robert Jacoby potentially being a cutout of sorts, but the thing is that his very first article about Einar Jennings finding the UFO, that there were actual unintended consequences for Dougie Milford, and for his next article about all the kids return home safely, that Robert Jacoby was may or may not have been visited by Dougie Milford. So there is at least a real person behind this, and up until at least 1969, or at the latest 1969, there is some sort of consistency, but it's just that, once you get to these two different deaths, and then Then you have to like juggle around like this poignant story that might actually not be real, as it's held under scrutiny. But then you have a funeral card that substantiates like what he wrote in that article. And actually the last part, this is the last of my notes, but I did mention about how in this, during this point that 200 plus attended and Robert's ashes were scattered at Pearl Lakes. But later on, at least if we're going chronologically, Dr. Jacoby, it's when he's, I believe he's writing his appeal about, like, he's writing about Laura Palmer and his relationship with her, but he writes that he's bringing Robert's remains, being a, a short version of cremated remains with him. I don't know, like, I just don't believe that Dr. Jacoby would just like throw like 3/4 of the remains and he keeps them for himself. Like, and even though Robert, or not Robert, Lawrence Jacoby, he does lie, like straight up lie in this stuff regarding Laura Palmer, like saying she's 18 when she absolutely was not. You can at least see why he would put those lies in, but I don't see why he would lie about keeping Robert Jacoby's remains. I don't know, where do you stand on that?
Okay, so I think I could accept that did occur to me. I'm like, this is funny that even in death there's like a potential contradiction, but I could see I certainly know people who've kept part of remains and put them in one place and put them in another. That's a long time to wait, 3 years, and he's been to Hawaii a bunch of times since then, so it is a little odd. It's like, again, I think my explanation for my real world explanation for a lot of this is just Frost. I think maybe I'll save this discussion till the end because I think it's sort of an important point. But just to give you the brief kind of one liner on it, I think Frost is somebody who loves storytelling in the moment and sometimes actually can lose the big picture a little bit, which is funny because people talk about that more with Lynch and like Frost was the one who tried to keep everything on track and blah, blah, blah. And maybe that's true in some ways, but I actually find him most of all to be somebody who's sort of in love with like crafting the moment and not as concerned necessarily with how it fits into the whole sometimes. So stuff like that, it's like he had the image of Jacoby going out there on a surfboard and throwing the ashes in the bay. And it was like a nice image. And he put it in there, even though he'd already written something about ashes going somewhere else, which again, I can rationalize it as being different people, but I think it's almost like the span of years is the weird part. Like, why'd he wait 3 years to do that?
I think that's just what's the weird part is that because I, when I think of, the everything in the universe with the secret history, I always try to think that even if there's something unintended on Lynch or Frost, then in this case with Mark Frost, that you can kind of spin it into something that's really interesting or make connections that are really interesting to you at least. But when it comes to Robert Jacoby, I think because of stuff in the Twin Peaks Gazette and the Twin Peaks Post, it makes it like there's almost more credence to it. And then, like we're saying about the funeral card, is that those dates do substantiate, in theory, his previous article about Margaret. But then he's like completely contradicted himself. So.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, if I think about it, it's almost like the 1931 date doesn't align with any other say. Like, there's already three different timelines. It's almost a fourth timeline, because if it's 1931 that he's born, he'd be 16 when he wrote that article, which is a little old for the article. It's very or a little young to be writing that article. It's obviously way too old to be in third grade. It's too young to have been at the end of high school, at the end of World War II, because he would have only been 13 or 14 if he was born in 1931. So it's like it's actually a whole new it like even in death, it introduces one more timeline for him, which is nuts.
This is a little bit more of a broad stroke because I know people feel, strongly about like timelines and like, how they view it. Because when I think of timelines in Twin Peaks, I think it's like primarily two, where it's like, there's one where Laura Palmer gets murdered, the other where she goes missing because of Cooper's actions in Part 17. But for you, when it comes to three or four timelines, do you have a particular thought on what really prompts them or how Robert Jacoby factors into it?
So now I kind of alluded to this before, but I guess I would give my in-world kind of justification, the closest I can come to it having kind of a dramatic resonance, if not necessarily like being that legible, is there's something interesting about Jacoby, as you said, not that many contradictions up to 69. And then the newspaper is bought by Milford. He supposedly dies, yet he continues. And the name changes. It's the, is it the Gazette and then the Post, right? So there's like this very clean dividing line in the whole world of Robert Jacoby of like pre-69 and post-69. And then the post-69 stuff goes back into pre-69 and messes it up, but it's all stuff being written in post-69. So there's like a sort of an interesting thought there about Jacoby, Robert Jacoby, somehow kind of standing in for something about this town that almost gets like more rotten after 69. Like there's something that goes wrong, just like something goes wrong in 89 with Laura's death. There's like something about the end of Project Blue Book and Milford moving into town and kind of taking control of some of the local institutions that like Robert Jacoby is this sort of hapless townsperson caught up in the midst of all of it and reporting on, but also covering it up, that his contradictions that start to flower and, you know, mutate and become all this weird stuff after 69 in some way, you could parallel it to the town sinking into this kind of level of corruption and secrecy and stuff. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy because there's obviously a lot of darkness and drama in Twin Peaks way, you know, from its history. I mean, they go back to the Native Americans and all of that, and Lewis and Clark and all this stuff going on in the late 19th century. But, you know, there's a lot of narratives have multiple points where there's like a loss of innocence, and maybe that's one of them. And maybe you could read Robert Jacoby's collapse into an incoherent character who still is clinging to some sort of emotional core as being like representative of that. I do find it interesting that his final words at the end of the Log Lady tribute are "truthfully and respectively yours." And it's like, interesting way to end that by saying truthfully, you know.
But actually, this does make me think. It's been a while, and I forget where I heard it, but I was thinking that John Thorne, after he read The Secret History of Twin Peaks, and this has come back to 1969 specifically with the moon landing and the contradictory stamp that Norma had, he did bring that up to Mark Frost, and apparently Mark Frost was not happy because apparently that was a mistake on like an editor's part or, you know, someone on that end. But I think the stuff you're talking about does have that retroactively fit in because, you know, when it comes to something like that, you know, I feel like you can always have like a certain explanation of what prompted that. But yeah, in the case of like, you know, Robert Jacoby's writing and also these poignant moments that he talks about and even stuff that, you know, you can say is substantiated, like, you know, for example, you know, Margaret does indeed go missing in the woods. So the broad stroke of that is the same. And then, you know, this great story about her that he talks about in his final write in Twin Peaks Post, that's also very poignant. But it's just that it's just crazy to think that, you know, like this moon landing thing, it kind of just factors in with all these things that would go awry in 1969.
I know, right? It's like, it's perfect too. I mean, it's Altamont, it's Charles Manson, it's the end of the 60s. It's a date that I think does get mentioned in the show as like a turning point because of Project Blue Book. You know, I think we have like Windham Earle's video, I think is from a little bit before that, but that's kind of when he went, you know, when that whole project kind of, and Nixon is elected, well, Nixon becomes president. He's elected the year before. It's, and yeah, you have the football game in 68, you know, right before that. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, cycling back to Nixon, that's also the same time. I believe that's the same year that him, Dougie Milford, and Jackie Gleason, I forget what type of alien it is offhand, they do go to Florida and he shows them the alien. So there is a lot of weird stuff that goes on in 1969, and somehow Robert Jacoby is this small part of a larger picture.
Yeah, and I do kind of like the idea of this character. Like, there's something kind of pathetic about him in, like, the not completely dismissive sense of the word, you know, like pathos. Like there's just something about him that's like a little bit pitiable where it's like, he's, you know, we keep being told that he's like not telling us the whole story. And then here he is writing this long, pages long, columns long article about somebody he clearly loves. And his narrative is like falling apart in the process of telling it. Even just this thing, it's like, again, if I'm trying to stretch myself you know, like Taffy to come up with in-world kind of explanations or resonances for this. You could almost see it as like, maybe in addition to MS, he also has, you know, maybe he has some like dementia or something. Like he's having trouble keeping track of these things, and maybe he's writing about things that didn't actually happen and mishmashing like his affection for Margaret as an adult to like thinking they were kids together or something, you know? Yeah. So it's like, and you could see it as, and like maybe this sort of poignant aspect of this, like a King Lear type thing, is he spent his life kind of looking the other way and making sure he didn't step on the toes of, you know, giving out certain information. And this is now manifested as like almost like an illness, like a mental illness of like not being able, even when he wants to, not being able to. And now this is, we're going way, you know, I'm going pretty far to kind of rationalize what's going on with this character, but I do kind of, now that I'm playing with that idea, I kind of like it. It has some edge to it of like making sense of this character who's also all over the place and makes such an interesting kind of companion or contradiction to his brother.
On the topic of how Robert Jacoby may or may not have dementia, I actually was considering that for a time. And I think the only thing that I could think was that, you know, if that was the case, would that have been brought up by, you know, Major Briggs or Margaret Lanterman or Tammy Preston would, you know, bring that up later on? Because if we're talking about, you know, that he's like, you know, his mental health is diminishing, that like, you know, that would check out for why this article is so far off the mark. Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess if we're going with that, do you think there'd be any reason why Tammy, Margaret, or Garland would leave it out?
No, I mean, again, I really, like, I would be surprised if that was what was actually, like, Mark Frost was actually going for. Although I will say, his father was experiencing Alzheimer's at the time he was writing this, and that was obviously very much on his mind in terms of memory and life and passing away. So it's, you know, it's interesting that that is theoretically reflected in this article. It feels to me more like, as hard as it is to believe, that he just kind of was, had different drafts and kind of combined them at some point and they got like sort of jumbled up. But there is resonance to that. You know, the more I think about it, this idea of somebody struggling to kind of, the dark part of their life kind of infecting now what they want to be the positive part. I like that idea. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's possible. It is possible that he, it took us reading it like five times over like 7 years to even humor that possibility. So I'm not sure. It was pretty esoteric if that was what he was going for, but you know, I suppose it's possible.
I guess on a surface level, there is a certain irony to be had because Robert Jacoby is like this very respectable writer, very well liked in the community, if 200 plus people can come. But when you look at it at face value in the secret history, that somehow his brother, who is a much more odious person, very morally questionable, his stuff, even when he lies, you can tell that there's something a little more clear cut to it. And then meanwhile, his brother, with Robert, his stuff is like, you know, you have to like mine through all these little things.
Yeah.
Somehow with despite Dr. Jacoby's faults and foibles, the handful of times he lies, you can get why, even if it is just for awful reasons. But then with Robert, it's like there's these bizarre esoteric readings of, you know, going through his text or what Garland says or Tammy. Yeah, now that we're talking about this article, I feel like if you look at this in isolation, I think the dementia part might actually fit the bill for why he gets these details wrong, albeit it might may or may not diminish Margaret's story about Mean Sam and his subsequent death. But then if we do look at you know, Garland Briggs, where he said that he died in 1969, and you brought up the good point that he may have intended Richard. And, you know, we can say that whether it applies to Major Briggs or Mark Frost. But, yeah, somehow I feel like there's something at least a little more clear-cut if you kind of like, go with those ideas. But I don't know. I guess where do you stand on it?
Yeah, this is honestly, this conversation with you, I feel like is the first time I've even really teased that out. I don't even know going into this if that, I guess when I was reading it tonight, it first started to maybe think like, maybe there's something, you know, there's something with him. The fact that it's all the different people making these contradictions and that, like, as you said, like somebody somewhere, like Tammy is so eagle-eyed usually. It's odd that she doesn't footnote this, say, wait a second, the previous paragraph, you know, because Mark Frost does like to lampshade stuff like that. Like, he's usually not so subtle that it is like no kind of pointing us to whatever it is he's trying to do. So I don't know. Yeah, it's, I like the idea of it. I think it in some ways enriches the character again, because in a weird way, he's almost like the essence of Secret History of Twin Peaks, more than like Dougie Milford or Major Briggs or even Tammy Preston, you know? Like, of all the different narrators, he's the one. First of all, he's the only one that belongs totally to the book, you know, like he's not in any actual, like Tammy and the Major and Dougie are all in they appear in Twin Peaks. So there's that. And then there's the fact that like he is like the newspaper man, the one who's supposed to be like publicly, like the public face of kind of telling the truth about the community. And yet he's like, he has so many contradictions within himself in a book that has so many contradictions within itself. So there's something, yeah, there's ways in which Robert Jacoby feels like he's the heart of the secret history, the convoluted, divided heart of the secret history in some ways. And like the fact, I like the fact that at the end, there's like, in addition to all of the kind of surface level reportage, there's like this kind of emotional piece that he kind of ends with that itself has so many contradictions within itself. So yeah, it's like I can be critical of it in some ways, but it is what it is. It's in the book, it's a part of the text, and there are interesting ways to look at it, I guess I would say.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And yeah, I'm glad that we actually had this conversation, because this is the one of the few episodes where I felt like I wasn't properly prepared. And I just figured that like I might just fumble at the end of it. But yeah, I think that with like, you know, how we laid it out, I think we have a pretty good case in terms of why Robert Jacoby wrote the way he did and the hard cut from 1969 onward.
Yeah, and again, it's, you know, it doesn't explain a lot of the other contradictions, like, you know, again, Briggs in 69. It almost feels in some ways like more of like a spiritual explanation than like a rational one. Like, okay, it's hard to explain, but like if you look at it in this almost like allegorical light, there's something to it of like this division. One other thing, or I don't know if you want to mention it, but I know we talked before you started recording about a sort of a brief reference in the final dossier, which continues the tradition of contradiction. So the only mention I saw in the final dossier, which Frost followed up with a year after the Secret History, was in the Lawrence Jacoby section. Tammy mentions that, you know, Lawrence lived off when he was living, he lived in Hawaii for 2 years after he went there in 89. It says he lived off of various funds, including a tidy sum left by his brother Robert, which suggests, you know, that Robert had some money put away. So again, here's stuff I'm coming up with right now as we're talking about it that's occurring to me based on what we just talked about. On the one hand, there's a bit of a contradiction there, because despite that one mention of him being the editor publisher of the Gazette, and the only way he gets out of that is by dying, which we know he didn't die in 69. So that kind of negates him ever being editor publisher. It's just a weird thing for Briggs to mention. As far as we know, he was just a staff writer at this newspaper. Like, why would he have that much money? And one thought is, well, maybe Dougie Milford was, he was on his payroll, not just as a staff writer, but as like he kicked back money to cover up stuff, you know?
That is interesting, because yeah, his like it's like we were saying before, his first article was something that caught wind to Dougie, would prompt him to see Einar Jennings, and then Tammy does speculate his second article, which also does pertain to UFOs, that Dougie may or may not have had a follow-up with Robert in some capacity.
Yeah, there's like, yeah, I do like that. I hadn't even noticed that. So the fact you pointed that out, it's like, yeah, his first article is like kind of his most truthful in a way, where he's like, hey, something weird happened here. I don't know what it was, but here's all the details. And every story after that is like, something kind of odd happened. But hey, I mean, everything's all literally all's well that ends well is the name of the article. It's like, that's an odd art. That's an odd name for an article about three kids who went missing. Like, it feels like he's trying to sweep something under the rug, and then the football game and everything else and all of it. Yeah, it's just, it's interesting.
But yeah, I'm not sure if like Mark Frost, if we're just kind of like, really coming up to certain conclusions regarding the weird inconsistencies, or if this is some one thing that Mark Frost had, planned when he first started writing it. But yeah, no, I think that covers everything about Robert Jacoby. I guess before we wind down, I know you were mentioning Lost in the Movies and a lot of stuff you're working on, but was there anything else you want to show in terms of social media or anything else that you're doing at the time?
I guess I'd specifically highlight, I have a video essay from a few years ago that's like specifically, it's a chapter in Journey Through Twin Peaks that's like a half hour long and specifically focused on Mark Frost's like other work leading up to The Secret History, basically. And I think a through line of that, something that, I was mentioning earlier, how I kind of see his, I think a lot of times he gets pinned as like kind of the rational one who holds David Lynch down to earth. And like keeps him on track and is like, no, we got to follow the story. And in a weird way, I feel like that does a disservice to both Lynch and Frost. I think Lynch actually has more of a sense of structure and like, particularly like, really good at endings in a way that maybe he doesn't always get credit for, including from Frost. Like, Frost has been sort of dismissive of Lynch as like a story guy. He's like, well, he's an artist, but he doesn't really have the plot thing. It's like, well, I don't know. I think he has a really interesting kind of poetic sense of that, but it also undercuts Frost because it makes him sound like almost the spoil sport or something who's like, no, here's the nuts and bolts of what we got to do. And I think he's like a little bit more fanciful than that almost. Like if you actually read, I for this video that I did, I read like all of his novels, all of his sports nonfiction as well. And like at the end of the day, what really defines Mark Frost, and he will go like, he wanders, and I think Secret History proved this to a lot of people. He will wander a lot. Like, he's not necessarily Mr. Follow the Path, straight down the middle type guy. He is at least as much of a lover of like shaggy dog detours as Lynch is. But what really comes through is his love of like the process of storytelling, of like diving into a moment and painting a picture of like a setting and a character and like really exploring that. And I find oftentimes like his endings are not my favorite parts of his works. So like I almost see it a little bit opposite in some ways. Like he's the one who really like fills in all these wonderful flourishes along the route in a lot of ways. And I think that's true with Secret History. Like where it leads to in terms of season three, I think sometimes people try really hard to fit it into that, but it really feels more like he wrote this book for the love of all the details, more than necessarily what it was all adding up to. And I kind of like it for that. So anyways, to bring it back, I guess, to my work, that one video called The Bookhouse Boy, I think offers hopefully a good sweep of all the work that Frost has done. And it was kind of fun to do because, when I'm doing a video essay on the show, I've got all these clips to use, but for this, there was some stuff like Hill Street Blues and some of his movie work, but a lot of it was like novels. So I had to kind of come up with ways to illustrate it using like random things for B-roll or like images from the cover of the book or something. Like there's one where I'm comparing, one part where I'm comparing The Return to one of the novels he wrote called The List of Seven and how it has like a similar array of characters crossing the country, just like in The Return, and they're ending up, there's like an explosion in the desert, I think, and just all this stuff. And I'm kind of like have these faces floating on a map. So it's like kind of fun to come up with stuff for this. And I think I hope it offers people, because I feel like Frost doesn't often get enough kind of credit to being like a voice in his own right. And I hope looking at his very eclectic body of work like that gives people some sense of who he is as a creator and what he brought to Twin Peaks.
After reading Conversations with Mark Frost, I think that
And
was
that's
like
a
a,
great book too, by the way. I recommend that.
yeah, I think David Bushman did an incredible job of how widely ranged he can be because, I think while a lot of us think of him as a writer on TV or even like an author, but, you think of other stuff like Storyville or how multifaceted he gets with his books. He does fiction or he does young adult, he does sports books. So he is someone who's really passionate about a lot of different stuff. And I think coming back to the secret history of Twin Peaks, you can see even that, with like Meriwether Lewis or Chief Joseph, Jack Parsons, Fred Chrisman, that he finds a way to make the stuff that he loves, and he can find a way to, like, integrate that passion into it. I think that's,
Even a football game.
yeah, even a football game. He, like, just like the way that he, like, gets really, you can tell that he has, like, there's certain things that he loves, and he, I think, he integrates it pretty well. I think it was Jeremiah from Take the Ring. He said that the secret history is something that's best when you read it little by little, and because of the way I format my podcast, I think I can appreciate those little things that Mark Frost does bring. So yeah, I do agree that he is extremely multifaceted, and yeah, and I think, even I can, like, misconstrue, like, what he truly brings to Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you do all these episodes on secret history characters because you've had quite a few, as I recall. You had that, like you just mentioned, the one on, would Take the Ring where you're talking about Lewis and Clark. It's like there's the book is it's such a strange, wide-ranging, wild addition to the Twin Peaks universe. I kind of love that. I love the fact there's now like Richard Nixon is a character in Twin Peaks who owns the ring that ends up on Teresa Banks's hand like 15 years later. It's so nuts.
Oh yeah, no, like I said earlier, I did an episode on Dougie Milford, or at least I will be doing one soon, and I was shocked how much Richard Nixon was tied into the mythos of Twin Peaks. Like, even though I have notes about him separately, just seeing how much he's Alonzo with Dougie is just, like, the most incredible and bizarre thing at the same time.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I look forward to that Dougie episode because, we're talking about whether he's like a good guy, like he's kind of like a not a good guy, And Frost's politics are pretty clear. Like he's not that ambiguous about what his views on current politicians and political parties and all that are. And the fact that he makes Dougie such a like dyed-in-the-wool conservative Republican. But also, like, not just a villain in the book. Like, he's somebody who is treated with a certain amount of respect and even awe in terms of the life he leads. And I think Nixon fits that bill too, where it's like he's kind of fascinated by Nixon beyond just treating him as an antagonist. So it kind of adds an interesting ambivalence to the book that so much of it is through that persona.
But yeah, I think that wraps up everything. I just want to thank you for coming on. It's always great having you on for, like, these, like, super deep dives for any of the characters we cover.
This was an esoteric one, and like in a totally different way than the Renette's Angel episode. Like, two very kind of obscure, seemingly obscure parts of Twin Peaks, but for totally, totally different reasons, totally different creators, totally different things that parts of the Twin Peaks universe they inhabit. So I love that I got to do those back to back. Together.